Let me introduce what we're going to do by telling you that this seminar Sunday is called Friendship is Crucial, and it is basically notes or a little sort of introduction to a tiny little book that we've loved at Radiate this semester called True Friendship, written by Bon Roberts. He is the rector of St. Ives in Oxford and the very cool writer that writes lots of these small little books that are packed with just very good, solid biblical advice on different kind of topics. And for the past semester, we've been studying this book with Radiate, with our student group. So every Tuesday that we've gotten together, mostly every Tuesday, we've been studying one of the chapters in this book. And what I would like to do today, since we have all these copies that are going to literally go and sit at the our little ICL library, so ready for you to take it, I would like to introduce this book to you. I'm not going to go through all of the chapters, obviously. I'm not going to like sit here and read the book to you, although that thought crossed my mind. It is a really good book. I'm just going to sort of hopefully spark some, you know, like, why should we, you know, invest in friendships in this context? And just answer some questions, picking on particular chapters that were sort of important for me. And then, you know, you're invited to just read it. It's tiny, as you can see. It has six chapters, discussions at the end, so you can even do it with your small group or with your family if you want to. And man, I should be getting some sort of commission for, you know, advertising. They're so good. And if we do have time at the end, I would like to close, well, with conversation, but also with guiding you on a sort of guided meditation. But I can't make promises just if we have time, because look, you know. Now, okay, so friendship is crucial. First things first, why don't you look around and just think for yourself, do you find a friend's face near you? Do you see someone who's like, yes, you're my friend? Yeah, I hear some high fives, some good things going on. Okay, well, that's very good to hear because, you know, we are a church community, so that's nice. Yes, awesome. Okay, I just got these statistics. They are from the UK, so they think that they roughly apply to Europe. Apparently, one in 10 people answered this survey that is very recent, saying that they do not have a close friend, someone they can call a close friend, someone that they can, for example, you know, bother in the evening with problems or whatever. It's like the first person that would come to your mind when you want to share something, either hard or very happy, they could not find that person. And even one in five said that they felt unloved. I think that those are very, you know, it's like, wow. It is kind of like impressive to realize. But then, of course, I look at our context, you know, being an international community, and loneliness, maybe it's not a constant. I certainly hope it is not a constant in our lives, but there are definitely moments where we feel lonely, don't we? Where we feel a little bit disconnected, because it might be just a particular bad day or a rough week or something, and you just suddenly feel so alienated, so far away from maybe your family or your friends or, you know, what's going on. But for the people that answered this survey, this is a constant. This is not just, you know, having a bad day and thinking, oh, I don't have anyone to call, you know. So I think that it is very important, not for us just as students, you know, when we studied this book, but as church members, to reignite the value of friendship, of community. As you might guess, if you were here on our Celebrate Sunday and you read the pastor's notes about what our priorities are as a church for the coming year, very high up on our priorities was to invest in our community, to turn us into a tighter knit community. So obviously, seminar Sundays like this have to do with that. Like, my goal today is that we can go home thinking of practical ways, but also of deeper, sort of having a deeper sense of calling, of being a community, of really, really investing in friendships that are godly. So hopefully we can, you know, get some good pointers from here. Okay, so if you have Bibles, could I ask people to look? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. So could 4 people raise your hands if you have a Bible and you're willing to look for the passages? Max, could you look for Exodus 33:11? And Joyce, could you look for Isaiah 41:8? Could you look for Matthew 11:19? And Claire, look 12:24. So throughout the Bible, we are called friends. God calls often those who belong to him, those who are his people, his children. He also calls us his friends. Max, do you have the first one? Yes. Do you want to read it? Yeah, just loud and...
Yeah, okay.
Oh, I think that there's a mic coming.
The Lord will speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. Then Moses will return to the camp, but his young aide, Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent.
Cool, yeah. Thank you. So God spoke to Moses as one speaks to a friend. Yes.
Isaiah 41, verse 8. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, you, descendants of Abraham, my friend.
Yeah, thank you. So here, God mentions Abraham as his friend.
Matthew 11, verse 19.
Yeah.
The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is justified by her deeds.
Thank you. Cool. That's a good, strong voice. Okay, I love this verse because they are actually trying to sort of find fault in Jesus. Like, look at him, you know, look at all what he's doing and who he's hanging out. But it's not just hanging out. It says here that he is a friend of sinners. I don't know about you, but I find that to be such a relief because it means that I get to be friends of Jesus, you know? It's like, oh, okay. If Jesus was a friend with sinners, it means that he is my friend even though I fall short every day, you know? And we can share that with others who don't know Jesus as well. You don't need to be like some sort of perfect caricature of a Christian to be friends with Jesus. He's friends with you from the start. Who had the last one, Claire?
Consider the ravens. They do not sow or reap. They have no storeroom or barn, yet God feeds them. And how much more valuable you are than birds.
Okay, thank you. So, to wrap it up, how deep the care that... Whoa! Oh, look. Okay. How deep the care that God has for us, that he explicitly says in the Bible, we are more valuable, we are the sort of the high point of creation. And I mean, if you study any sort of natural sciences or sciences in general, and you realize how intricate and wonderful and just like, you know, brain explosion of incredible creation is, like in any field that you are, you know, I have a relative who is in genetics, and every time she talks to me, I'm just like, wow, you know. And then that God says about us that we are just like the sort of high point of creation, us, you know, like the same people that made consistently a mess of this planet. I'm just like, whoa, okay. We get to be friends with God, you know. It's like, okay. Okay, so we are called friends, but when God calls us friends, there's also a calling behind it. It's not just we get to be friends with God, but also we are friends so that we can be friends. I love this picture here. It's a very old, I'm thinking Byzantine icon that the French community of Tessé uses. It's like their logo, sort of to speak. And the way that they present it is that this icon is called Jesus and the Believer, or Jesus and the Disciple, or something like that. It's not meant to be any particular disciple. It's meant to be any of us. Anyone who is a believer and walks with Jesus side by side. And Jesus is kind of like holding their shoulder, you know, kind of being like, we're friends. you know. I love that. I love that image. And let me just read. I've put several quotes from the book of friendship, and this is one of them. In his essay on friendship, C.S. Lewis points out that while lovers are often seen face-to-face delighting in each other, the characteristic post of friends is side-by-side or shoulder-to-shoulder. And that is the sort of metaphorical pose that we should aim with one another, especially within the church. Outside the church, of course, but especially within the church, that should be the sort of metaphorical pose in which we are constantly find walking with one another, shoulder to shoulder, close to one another. Okay, now, I am sorry to all the men in the room, but, and honestly, this is not me, this is the book, so whatever you don't disagree, it's like, blame him. He speaks a little bit about the challenges of making friends and having friends in adulthood. And I don't know if you've realized, but it was a lot easier when we were children, wasn't it? Like, it literally all it takes for children to be friends when they're young is to put them together in the same room. That's it. Like, after a while, they will be friends. I have two very, very close friends from Chile. And the only reason why we are friends, we did not go to the same school or to the same church. We didn't grow in the same circles, but both of our moms were very, very good friends from childhood themselves. And we seldom saw each other, maybe like, I don't know, 3 or 4 times a year. But when we did see each other, because our moms wanted to catch up so badly, they would just throw us together in one room. It's like, force us to be friends, you know, just play together. And then our moms would be, you know, catching up happily. And after a few years, it just became kind of a ritual. And then when we were older and we were both all in university and we had more independence to move around, we just actually started hanging out a lot more because it just had been so natural. And now we're still very good friends, and it's amazing. But that doesn't happen that easily when you're an adult, right? Especially if you're living in a country that is not yours. So say that you came to Leiden to study or to work, and then you find yourself here as a grown-up. And it's not just as easy as, I don't know, joining a gym and being like, hey, who's going to be my friend? Believe me, I've tried. It doesn't work like that. I don't know if it's just the Netherlands, but people are very focused in the gym or whatever other sort of context. They just go there, do their sport, and then go home. And you're like, yeah. It's like, I thought we were going to hang out after, you know, just eat some ice creams to undo all the sport that we just, no, it's just me. Yeah, okay. So, I don't know, has anyone else experienced difficulties of making new friends as a grown-up? It's just me? Is anyone else? Okay, good to know. Yeah. But overall, Mr. Roberts here, the author, says that historically, women have been more ingrained towards being more sociable, towards reaching out to friends, towards sharing with each other. It doesn't mean that we're just built that way. It means that, you know, like historically, we've been always the ones that, you know, are more sociable or are more emotional or, you know, all you want to think about what has been said or what has been sort of, you know, built about women. But men, of course, historically have the kind of polar opposite. So especially men in the West have historically been told that they have to be self-sufficient and resilient and almost made of steel and have no emotions and just like, you know. And so it's very hard for men nowadays to be vulnerable and real with each other. You can have like, you know, music bandmates, or you can have, I don't know, your team that plays football with you, for example, but rarely those connections become actual intimate, vulnerable friendships where you reach out and you share to a different level. With women, it seems to be more easier, even though, of course, it does present several challenges. But yeah, I don't want to go into all of it, but I do want to read a couple of quotes from the book. Men are not helped to form deeper friendships by the widespread social expectations that they should be self-reliant. And there's also an extra point that I wanted to add with these two pictures. I call it the Salmon Frodo dilemma. And it's basically the sort of social expectation that we have, I guess, especially in our cultures, that if two men are particularly close friends, they have to be gay. Like, they can't just be that close friends. You know, Sam and Frodo? No, no way. They can't just be, you know? And that is something, it touches on something that we're going to talk after, that is what the author calls the, I can't remember how he calls it, the idolatry of eros or something. But it's basically the idea that if two women are very close friends, yeah, they're besties, that's okay. But if two men are close, close friends to the point of Sam and Frodo, for example, from The Lord of the Rings, or Sherlock and Watson, they have to be in a relationship. Like, it can't be that they are just that good friends. That's just, I don't think so. And something that attests to that is that when the BBC, the BBC version of Sherlock came out some years ago, there was this incredible huge wave of fan fiction, like drawings and sort of parallel stories told by fans of the show, in which they were not just friends working together, they were definitely in love with each other, because they just could not tolerate that two men were just good friends, sharing life, living in the same apartment, and just solving crimes together. That's not possible. And it is hard for our society to actually come to those terms. I don't know. Of course, I don't experience the world as a man, so I can't fully, share on your experience. But I don't know if that has ever happened to some of the men in this room, that they just have a good friend and it just can't be. I used to have, my very best friend from high school was a man. And so obviously we constantly had to put up with the sort of questions of, come on, you're really dating, aren't you? Or let's just wait for it. It's a ticking bomb. At some point, they're going to date. No, we didn't. We never did. But of course, we did ask ourselves the question. It's like, okay, everyone seems to expect us to date just because we're good friends. Should we? Is this how we want to do? And we had a very mature and honest conversation about it. And we realized that, no, we really were just good friends. And we continued to be good friends. And it was a beautiful friendship that flourished and lasts until today, even though we live in two different continents. But there was definitely that sort of pressure, that expectation, that lack of understanding that, that you can just, be friends. And then there's another quote from the book that says, unless men are able to resist this unhelpful understanding of masculinity, sometimes called toxic masculinity, and be able to be vulnerable with each other, they will always have companions, but not friends. This is very challenging. Again, I'm not a man. I'm just, repeating what he said. But I see how this is very, very challenging. But I think that that is why church communities allow us possibly the best space to explore friendships, because it should be as safe as it gets. Nothing is going to be as safe as whatever has Jesus in the middle. So, I think that we should be doing something. And again, I'm going to sort of throw the ball here, but I think that a practical step towards promoting friendships and people knowing each other, especially men knowing each other, would be, for example, bring back the men breakfasts. Or not looking at anyone in particular, but bring back the men's ministry, barbecues, breakfasts. I see some nudges going on. Great. but that's really, really important. I think it needs to happen. I've been reading a lot, not only on friendship, but also several other books by authors that are related to each other. And another author, Andrew Sullivan, that is quoted a lot in this book, he wrote another book about sexuality in the church. And something that he mentions that I thought was striking, and I'm sorry I didn't put it here, was that, and this is a bit of a side note, but I think that by now it's very obvious that the numbers and the levels of porn addiction in the world, it doesn't matter if it is church or secular world, there is just a statistical numbers of young men and men of every age who are constantly, constantly watching porn are just enormous. And one of the things that this other author, Andrew Sullivan, speaks about is that in friendship, in men being vulnerable with each other and being able to share with each other, there is possibly the greatest antidote to this, especially within a church context. One of my favorite TED Talks is called, I don't know if it's called like this, but it says that the antidote or the opposite of addiction is not, I don't know, rehabilitation or however you want to think it, is relationships, is connection. The opposite of addiction is connection. When you are in a point where you are addicted to something, be it drugs or be it porn or be it sugar, the opposite of that, the way to get out of that, is through connection, through network. I find that so beautiful and challenging, but because it puts us all on the spot. I think that that's one of the biggest challenges in this book, as we're going to get to it, is that it forces us all to be part of the other's experience. I'm sorry, enough to grilling men. I just wanted to throw that out there because I think it's really important. I think that we can talk a lot about friendship and then keep on having sort of superficial friendships, but there is a big elephant in the room, and that is friendships are harder for men because you never got raised, or most of you never got raised to searching for friendships, to investing in friendships. So, yeah, this is, you know, hopefully someone felt very touched to start the men's ministry again or to at least reach out to others. But yeah, okay, so this is possibly one of the biggest themes that sort of crosses the book. And it has to do with why it is so hard for us to focus on friendships. See, the reason why at Radiate we wanted to, like with our sort of mini leadership team that we have at Radiate, we wanted to study this book was because right before, the semesters before, we had been talking a lot about relationships and the classic questions that we get from university students, which is very obvious because they are in that moment in life where they are thinking about relationships, about maybe getting married, about, you know, what they want to do romantically. And we realized that especially for us, we've been growing up in a society that is absolutely obsessed with romance, with love, with the idea of a romantic other. And the problem with that, of course, is that it makes it the ultimate goal of our emotional lives. We grow up thinking that the best thing that is going to happen to us emotionally is to either get married or find the partner of our lives, the love of our lives, and that's it. After that, it's over. After that, it's like you stay with them or, you know, whatever. But it's kind of like this mountain going up, you know, and then you find them and you get married. And then it's like, it's a mystery after that. Don't worry about it, you know. That's when, you know, that's when the real thing begins. But the problem with this view that is not just secular, it's also very, very much within the church, is that it leaves aside friendship. It leaves aside the wider community. I think that, I speak about a lot about the sort of the Western culture because I've been I've been privileged in a way that I was raised outside of, you know, the regular Western culture, but with like a very good understanding of it. So I come from a country where we are a little bit more communal, like a little bit more community-oriented, but I've been able to experience and to sort of understand to an extent the individualistic view of the Western culture. So, you know, just the nuclear family or just one person or two people, and that's about it, you know, not like the wider, like I'm used to big families, big crowds of people, children being raised by uncles and grandparents and like a whole mix of people, not just mom and dad, and then seeing uncles one time a year for Christmas or for a birthday. That's strange for me. But it does give me some sort of insight on, what goes on here? Now, the reason why I throw this all in the mix is because we focus on just us, and then just us finding the other person. And then when that fails, or when that takes too long to happen, we think that we're miserable. We think that something is wrong. So I think, and the author of the book happens to agree with me. Other way around. We think that we've approached it the wrong way. We grow up looking for romance, for the love of our lives, when we should grow up investing in friendships and eventually, possibly, love would come out of that. But not necessarily. See, the Bible never says that we are made for marriage. And I know that I'm married, so that kind of defeats like the authority of who speaks, but the author isn't. The Bible never says that we are made for marriage. It says that we are made men and women in the image of God, men and women working together, ruling the earth, being fruitful. But that being fruitful doesn't necessarily mean being married and making babies. It also means like investigating what happens around us. It also means literally building. It also means managing the water so that we can live 6 meters underwater and are not all, you know, swimming, etc. It means literally being fruitful in all kinds of ways, not just with babies. But at some point, we kind of lost track of it, and we thought, we are meant for marriage. That's our goal in life, except that it wasn't. And then, after some decades of this sort of train of thought, you have, you know, the singles groups in churches. And that is basically like either the sort of meet and, how is it called, like matchmaking group, you know, it's like the singles group where you go and meet your future partner, or the people who are just like, you know, thinking that they don't have a purpose or that they don't have, that they are not blessed or whatever because they are not in a romantic relationship. Okay. I'm rambling. Let me read this quote. Marriage was not supposed to fill all our relational needs. The result is that they, the people in a marriage, not only put impossible burdens on each other, but also give insufficient attention to other friendships. Single people suffer from the same delusion, too often believing the lie that they are bound to experience miserable, isolated lives unless they can find a spouse. So, not focusing on friendships, not focusing on community is bad for everyone involved. Because marriages, because of, you know, all these years of us thinking that the greatest thing that's going to happen to us is finding the love of our life, and what we once we find it, it's almost like they're going to solve our every need. That's a huge problem, isn't it? That's actually one of the leading causes of why there's so much divorce outside and within the church. It's because watch any movie for children where there's like a happy wedding at the end and you realize that they don't seem to need anyone else. The literary topic of the star-crossed lovers, for example, where you have Romeo and Juliet and all they need is each other. That is not how communities are built. That is not at all what the Bible portrays. The Bible never speaks about a man and a woman doing it all and not needing everyone else. The Bible speaks about communities ingrained with each other, interwoven. It is never one marriage. It is not even like leading a church. It is always a community together. So, and of course, you know, then you have the classic, the sort of evident challenge for singles in this mindset that would be great. So I'm kind of on standby until I can find someone. No, of course not. But that also means that we need to be the community. We need to be the family for those who don't have that, for those who don't have the nuclear family here, for example, in the Netherlands. You know, if we're a nuclear family of four, but we also know that there is someone that don't have a spouse at the moment, then how can we as a church say, okay, well, you have fun living on your own and coming home to an empty house every day and doing your thing? We can't. That's the huge, big challenge that this book poses and that I think the narrative in the Bible poses, is that we can't just say, you go and do your alone life, and we're gonna be like the several little nuclear families in the church and we come together on a Sunday, we have to be more involved than that. And of course it's hard, but I think that it's a very sort of clear challenge. I'm going to read that verse, but a bit later. So yeah, I'll just try to remember it. If not, someone can try to remember it for me. Okay, another quote from this talk on marriage and singleness and all that. After Christ's return, there will be no marriage. That's from Matthew 22:30. But great intimacy will be enjoyed in the beyond sexuality delight of friendship with one another as God's people in the new creation. Okay, so I love this quote because it raises a kind of important topic, which is the idea of intimacy. The idea of, you can tell me, okay, Paulina, great, so you're saying I don't need to get married, that's not the main goal of my life, and I can have a fulfilled and fruitful, in God's eyes, life as, for example, a single person, right? That's what you're saying? Great, but what about real intimacy? That is only found in marriage. That is only that. I can't really have true, deep, fulfilling intimacy with a friend. That's weird, because intimacy is sex, isn't it? Okay, don't do this. Please don't do it. But I'll tell you what happens if you Google intimacy. There's like, everything is about sex. Some things are blatantly about porn. So just don't Google image it. That's just, don't do that. But I'm just telling you anyways what happens if you do that. That's what you do. That's what happens. You get a lot of pictures about sex. Because, again, in our culture, we've learned to equate intimacy with sex to the point that you actually find them as a synonym for each other. And so that also puts us in a bit of an uncomfortable situation because, again, the Bible never says that intimacy is equal to sex. Actually, the main and first source of intimacy that the Bible speaks about is in community with God, in prayer, in being in His presence. I'm going to check quickly with my husband if he lets me share something about when we started dating. Yeah, he said yes. Okay. Awesome. Thank you, honey. Okay, so Jerome and I started dating when we were 21 in Germany. That's where we met. And we were Christians, and we were dating, and we just started, and we kind of wanted to figure out this whole dating thing because I was from Chile. I still am. He's from France, and we were in Germany, and we were obviously not going to stay in Germany. So we wanted to know if it even made sense to date. We obviously were very attracted to each other and we were like googly eyes and all that, right? But, you know, so we were hanging out one day and we just said, why don't we pray together? And that was by far the most fulfilling, I don't know even how to explain it, but in movies and in books and in general culture, couples usually speak about reaching new levels of intimacy, always related to sex. Okay, so Jerome and I didn't have sex before we got married, but we did pray together. And now that we have been married for a while and we also know what sex is about, I can tell you the level of intimacy and connection that we've experienced when we were dating, praying together. Wow, I mean, like, that's it. I don't know how to explain it, but real intimacy has a lot to do with being in the presence of God. I think that the source of it is really God's presence. So we might always, if we don't know God, we might always be searching for that intimacy. And we can try to find it with boyfriends or girlfriends or spouses. We can try to find it with friendships or whatever else, but we are always going to be lacking something. Because the real source of fulfilling intimacy comes from God. And so this is a good reminder as well, you know, for to kind of like bang our little heads a little bit with the idea that even if we're aware of it or not, we probably all grew up with thinking that, you know, that the greatest relationship of our lives was going to be with our spouse. And don't get me wrong, like, marriage is great, and it is a fantastic thing to be married, but it doesn't need to be the ultimate relationship. And also for people who are married, we need to make space to invest and to grow friendships. Okay, so this is a little bit what I was speaking about beyond nuclear families or so. So obviously in a church, you have you have the nuclear families, you have people who are single, but what kind of church do we want to be in terms of welcoming and embracing people who are not only single, but also probably same-sex attracted? So the author of this book, Vaughan Roberts, is part of an ever-growing group of men, right now mostly in the UK and the States, that define themselves as same-sex attracted. And they define themselves like that because they don't like to use the term gay, because what they believe is basically that they believe the Bible's teachings in that if you experience attraction for your same sex, then that they take that as a calling for celibacy. They're not going to deny it. They don't deny that they are not attracted, for example, in this case, to women, but they're not going to act on it either. And they decide, and that is their sort of their Bible reading, and that's how, you know, where they come along in their faith journey, that they are going to be celibate. And now they've, you know, they have groups and they have conferences and so on, but they write about having the support of a family that is not their biological family. They write that what in the secular world would be understood as these bigot Christians forcing people to run away from real love, you know, from companionship, from family for the rest of their lives, doesn't have to be so. Basically, what they argue is that us, the church, are challenged with being that family for them. Not just for them because they are same-sex attracted, for everyone and anyone in our communities who don't have, for example, a nuclear family. So, let me read a couple of quotes. Committed long-term friendships are an important witness to the possibility of real intimacy and relational security outside or alongside marriage. Our culture, with its low view of friendship, doubts that it is possible, and for that reason, believes that churches who urge members to uphold the Bible's teachings and remain celibate rather than enter a same-sex partnership or marriage with a non-Christian are condemning them to a life of sustainable isolation. Our society's obsession with sex and its assumption that any especially close relationship, even between two people of the same gender, may have a sexual element to it, whether acted on or not, has sadly raised suspicions about such friendships. So, the first one, obviously, he's speaking about how we need to make it possible to be the family for people who are going to decide, this is how I'm going to live, you know? If not, of course we are condemning gay people or same-sex attracted people to a life of miserable isolation, and not just them, but whoever happens to be single in our church. We can't let that happen. If we want to be, I think, of course, I don't know exactly where all of us stand in these terms that are, in these issues that are, obviously, you know, there's a wide range of positions. But if you do think that that people who are followers of Christ, who are Christian, and are same-sex attracted, should not be married, should be celibate, then it is also your responsibility to be the family for them. And then what he says refers to how we sometimes tend to look at friendships and think, the Sam and Frodo dilemma that I was speaking about before. We also need to, like, stop it with that. We need to stop thinking that every time two men are good friends or two women are good friends, then not really, you know, like they have to be, there has to be something else going on. Yeah. Okay, so now going to the good place. It has to start with Jesus. I know that there's all that I have said is very challenging, and yeah, probably not as nice as you thought when I said that we were going to speak about friendship. Sorry, but here's the thing: it has to start with our friendship with Jesus. Nothing can spring from just our good intentions. For example, I love in the Bible where it says we all fall short of God's perfectness, of God's goodness. Everyone. So no matter how good our intentions are, if whatever project we have, if whatever intention of friendship we have doesn't come from Jesus, doesn't start from Jesus, then it's not going to get much, you know, it's not going to get very far. Our self-centeredness is what destroys our relationships. They cannot be fixed from within, but rather need a deeper love that comes from outside ourselves, the love of God in Christ. So yes, we tend to make a mess of things because we're human and we're sinners. That's no news. So we tend to make a mess sometimes of relationships too. The fix for that doesn't come from within. We can spend years sort of, you know, reaching inside and just like exploring our inner lives or whatever you want to call it. You're not going to get it. You're not going to find it. That inner peace, it has to come from God. And it's the same, the healing thing in relationships, it can't come from within us. It has to come from God. It is God's peace. It is God's love that teaches us how to love. And so we can't attempt to understand or to be able to invest in friendships if we don't first have a friendship with Jesus. And then the next quote says, many of our relationships are insecure because we feel we have to earn the approval and affection of others, and we're never quite sure we have done enough. I don't know if that relates to any of you. Have you ever thought that, you know, like, that you have to be maybe cool enough to be friends with someone, or that when you are starting a friendship, you have to really earn that sort of, that love, or that respect, or that approval, and you have to work a little hard for it. It is not like that with Jesus. With him, we are always safe. Our relationship with God, by contrast, is completely secure. And a relationship, a friendship that is going to spring from that context is always secure as well. You have to, you can just rest in that. Okay, I love this quote. It's from Henry Nouwen, who is a Dutch theologian. So, yeah, good. It's a bit long, but bear with me. No friend or lover, no husband or wife, no community or commune will be able to put to rest our deepest cravings for unity and wholeness. And by burdening others with those divine expectations of which we ourselves are only partially aware, we might inhibit the expression of free friendship and invoke instead feelings of inadequacy and weakness. It is sad to see how sometimes people suffering from loneliness, often deepened by the lack of affection of their immediate family circle, search for a final solution for their pains and look at a new friend or a new lover or a new community with messianic expectations. Okay, so this touches on, yeah. This touches on what happens if you go to the other extreme. So obviously, what I've been hopefully trying to say somewhat clearly today is that there is a greater challenge in us as a church community to build friendships that are more godlike, that are more giving, that are more caring, that are more careful of each other, you know, that are more present. But at the same time, we can't go to the other extreme, which would be as individuals, to put all the weight of our almost our salvation on a friend or even a spouse or a community. So you can't just, you know, come to a church and say, okay, now I'm your problem, basically. You know, like, you have to fix me, and you have to sort me out, and you have to save me. It has to start with God. So there, we need to sort of find that balance. I think that, and I definitely, honestly believe that there is a greater challenge for us as ICL, you know, to grow better friendships, to find spaces of being vulnerable with each other. An example that I love is what has been happening with the women's ministry through the lunches. A lot of women have gotten to know each other and have deepened their friendships. It doesn't mean that the lunches are magical. It's still a big group of women meeting. So obviously we don't get to talk about really deep, well, sometimes we do, to be honest, but, you know, it doesn't mean that we're going to grow friendships just because we meet roughly once a month. But it is a platform for us to keep in touch with one another, to actually meet people that we hadn't met before. And I think that we need more of that as a wider church community. But at the same time, we can't go to the other extreme and put all of the weight, all of the expectations on a community or on a friend or on our boyfriend or girlfriend. They are not Jesus. Jesus is Jesus. So just a quote to finish from, yeah, I don't know how to pronounce that, but what more sublime can be said of friendship? What more true, what more profitable than it ought to and it is proved to begin in Christ, continue in Christ, and be perfected in Christ? So, no more slides. Look, am I allowed to? Yeah, okay. He says yes. I hope that it kind of makes sense to you. The book, I have to say, is a lot more practical. I just wanted to touch on the more controversial points of it and the sort of invitation or challenges. You know, I just wanted to challenge us a little bit on why it is important that we work on our friendships. But the book actually offers very, very practical advice on how to do that. Now that you're maybe hooked on, okay, I need to work better on my friendships, or I need to, you know, reach new levels in the friendships that I already have, then how do I do that? So the book offers, honestly, very, very solid, easy to apply advice. And for example, some of the chapters are: true friendship is crucial, true friendship is close, true friendship is constant, candid, careful, and Christ-centered. And so, yes, you are welcome to take them home, give them a, you know, browse through them, and hopefully, you know, work on our friendships. And now I would like to do an imaginative prayer with you. So for that, I'm going to ask you to get comfortable and close your eyes. And just don't worry, it's a safe space. Get very comfortable. And what I would like you to do is, I would like us all to go back to when we were 10 years old. So try to remember yourself at 10. Try to think about where you might have been, maybe an outfit that you particularly liked, maybe a toy that you had always with you. Just try to really, really be in that moment. Be that 10-year-old child again. And I'm going to guide us through this meditation. God, I pray that you will release our imagination and help us to hear you speak during this time together. We open our hands to you. We open our ears to you. Come, Holy Spirit. With your eyes closed, imagine with me that you are one of the smartest people in your school or your neighborhood. Imagine that everyone looks up to you because you are so smart. Imagine you are invited to all the birthday parties. And when a game is being played, you are always the first one to be picked. Imagine when your teacher asks a question that no one else knows the answer to, you raise your hand and answer it. Imagine people always ask you to do something. They always invite you to help them with their projects because you're so smart. And you also play sports. Imagine you're good at sports, and everyone wants you on their team. What if you did everything just right? Imagine you always do the right thing, that you listen to your mom or dad and do what they say, and you serve in your community. You're always helping people. Imagine you give all your allowance money to the poor. Maybe you give all your money away that you earn from chores around the house. Imagine if you give it all away to orphans living in Cambodia or India or Syria. What would it feel like to be good at so many things, to do the right thing so many times, to always be liked, to always be invited, to always be picked first to be on a team? The Apostle Paul tells us that even if all these things were true, none of it would matter if we didn't love people. Jesus came to show us what it means to love. The Apostle Paul wrote a letter to people just like you and me living a long time ago. He's trying to help them understand that love is the most important thing. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. Amen. You can open your eyes now. Okay, I think that we're going to call it coffee time. Thank you so much. If you have questions, come to me. And the books are there. You can just take them. And if not, I'm just going to put them in the bookstore. Okay.